oil will fall on its own, with absolutely no need for government subsidies or taxes that attempt to influence the right decision, but inevitably usher in the wrong one. Corn ethanol, anyone?
ADD moment. Yes, I understand that relying on free markets to make the right choice in the future is dangerous. Not because the markets might be wrong, they almost never are over the long term, but because they may not exist.
Our green energy prospects depend on our ability to use more of our own oil. And the most obvious place to get it is from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, in Alaska. Estimates on the amount of recoverable oil in ANWR range from 2 billion to 16 billion barrels, meaning that one small area could produce anywhere from 500,000 to 1.5 million barrels per day, thereby saving us $135 to $327 billion in oil imports. In addition to creating an estimated 60 to 130,000 jobs, ANWR drilling would also allow government to stuff its own coffers. Companies must bid for the right to explore for energy on federal land, such as ANWR, and the revenue from those bonus bids goes straight to the federal government. Think of it as eBay for Uncle Sam. The government also collects 12.5% in royalties when federal land is used for energy production. If ANWR were producing oil, our government could rake in an additional $38 billion, while the Alaskan government will pull in at least $700 million a year in royalties.
But all to the detriment of the cuddly polar bears, you scream from your parents' basement.
Not so much. ANWR technically encompasses 19 million acres, but thanks to a congressional amendment, drilling would disturb only 2,000 of them, about the size of the University of Florida campus. Plus, wildlife has already been shown to be largely unaffected by oil development elsewhere in Alaska. The caribou herd that migrates through the Prudhoe Bay oil fields has grown from 3,000 to 32,000. Brown bear, fox, and bird populations are just as healthy as those in the surrounding areas.
Drilling in ANWR or offshore is pointless anyway. It'll take 10 years before we get the oil.
In 1996, we had a chance to drill in ANWR, but President Clinton vetoed it. If he hadn't, we'd be swimming in that oil now, instead of still talking about how it's a decade away. It's kind of like dieting. Instead of saying, but it'll take a year to lose 25 pounds, and continuing to eat your way through the Waffle House menu, you could actually start a diet. The same idea holds true for offshore drilling. President Bush planned to open hundreds of millions of acres off the U.S. coast to oil and gas drilling, but President Obama has put that idea on hold for further review. The Interior Department estimates that 18 billion barrels of oil, even more than ANWR's estimated capacity, and 76 trillion cubic feet of natural gas would have been tapped under the plan.
Oh, sure, we get a lot of oil, along with a lot of dead marine life.
What the environmentalists don't tell you is that a whopping 47% of total petroleum leaked into marine environments is actually from natural seepage, meaning that Mother Nature has some seriously overactive pores. Only 4% of total petroleum seepage comes from offshore oil and gas development. Guess where a big chunk of the remaining oil leakage comes from? Tankers and barges. There's a reason that when you hear oil spill, you think of giant tanker disasters like the Exxon Valdez and not offshore rigs. Between 1971 and 2000, tankers and barges were responsible for 61% of all oil spilled in U.S. waters.
Now let me think out loud for a second here. How could we possibly reduce the amount of oil spilling from tankers and barges into U.S. waters?
I know! We could drill for our own and transport it through pipelines, which accounted for a mere 2% of the total oil spillage in U.S. waters during the same time frame. In other words, if we stop relying on drunk tanker captains to get our oil from across the globe, both the environmentalists and consumers would win.
I don't care about the numbers. Oil is yesterday's energy source. Good riddance. Pooey on you. It's time to get on the new renewable energy bandwagon or get left in the dust.
I'm trying, but some of the biggest opponents of alternative energy happen to be members of the green movement. Maybe they should get their house in order before they start inviting guests over for dinner. The latest trend is for environmentalists to whine about the very wind and solar energy they supposedly support. Yes, they still drool over these sources like a 12-year-old boy walking past Victoria's Secret, but only when they're developed, installed, and used exactly the way they suggest. The private sector is jumping at the opportunity to expand alternative energy, just as the greenies seem to be turning away from it. Former oil man T. Boone Pickens mounted a $58 million campaign to promote his wind farm idea, something that you'd have to be a hermit to not know about at this point. Similarly, Cape Wind is preparing to build America's first offshore wind farm in the waters off of Cape Cod, Massachusetts, but their plans are being slowed by, wait for it, green energy supporters. Cape Wind's farm would occupy 25 square miles of water in Nantucket Sound, a plan that would make America only the sixth country in the world to harness offshore wind power. Supporters estimate the farm would reduce greenhouse gas emissions at a level equivalent to taking 175,000 cars off the road per year. Cape Wind says its 130 towers would meet 75% of the region's electricity needs and reduce carbon emissions by about 734,000 tons annually. So, what's the problem? Well, it turns out that Senator Ted Kennedy, one of the original crusaders for action on global warming, was opposed to the project. Why? Presumably because it would have ruined the view from his Hyannis Port vacation home. Yes, that's right. NIMBY, not in my backyard, has at least for the rich and famous turned into NIMOV, not in my ocean view. In 2006, Kennedy inserted an undebated amendment into a Coast Guard bill that would have killed Cape Wind. Thankfully, the public caught wind of it. Thanks, I'll be here all week, try the veal. And the backlash forced him to do a 180. But the eyesore argument isn't the only reason why the green lobby is turning against both onshore and offshore wind farms. They also claim that the turbines harm property values. They're dangerous. Their output is spotty. Turns out, you need the wind to be blowing. Who knew? They could harm birds, and they're expensive.
ADD moment. I don't know if these green lobbyists have noticed, but, you know what else is dangerous and expensive? Foreign oil.
Solar farms are facing similar opposition from so-called environmentalists. A mini gold rush is happening with solar projects in the California desert due to the plentiful sunshine, high altitude, level ground, and, well, general lack of any other possible way to use a ridiculously hot, sand-covered, barren desert for anything productive. Pacific Gas and Electric is buying enough solar-generated electricity to power 239,000 California homes. That may not sound like much, but this deal would nearly double the nation's total solar capacity. I say would because, once again, a plan to actually turn blueprints into green energy is facing resistance from the very people who should be supporting it. It turns out that the locations of the most proposed solar farms are also home to the Mojave ground squirrel, the desert tortoise, and the burrowing owl. Apparently, none of those animals would be able to live with some mirrors scattered along the ground, so environmentalists want the solar project stopped. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and I may not agree on everything, but he echoed my thoughts on this story perfectly when he said, "If we cannot put solar power plants in the Mojave Desert, I don't know where the hell we can put it." One big problem that environmentalists have with the solar and wind farms is that they require transmission lines to get the energy from the source all the way back to power plants and homes. For instance, California approved the Sunrise Power Link to connect San Diego to solar, wind, and geothermal energy being harnessed in the Imperial Valley. The transmission line has very tight environmental standards. It would circumvent a state park, an Indian reservation, and a forest,
and builders are not allowed to disturb burrowing owls and rattlesnakes. But, of course, none of that is good enough for groups like the Sierra Club, which is opposing the project and taking its case to the state Supreme Court. I guess the bottom line is, clean energy might be all right, so long as it doesn't have to be transferred to places where it can actually be used.
That's why we need to get the government more involved. If they don't pass new laws and regulations, Americans will never change their energy habits.
In March 2008, when going to the gas station was becoming cruel and unusual punishment, Americans drove 11 billion miles less than the previous March. It was the steepest decrease in driving since they began keeping records during World War II. Gas consumption was also down from the previous year, and public transportation ridership was at a 50-year high. There was no government decree mandating those changes. People altered their behavior because of two things we're now trying very hard to eliminate: market forces and common sense.
ADD moment. Where's that flying car I've been promised since I was a kid? I mean, are you telling me that we have the capability to clone animals, spray cheese out of a can, and airbrush Susan Sarandon into something resembling a pretty human being? But we can't make a car hover? Something doesn't add up here. Who killed the flying car? I want answers!
When the government actually does try to influence energy behavior, it's usually with disastrous results. Take corn ethanol, for example. Completely smitten with the stuff, gee, could the $5.5 million the corn lobby gave to politicians from 2005 to 2008 have anything to do with that? The government subsidized corn for ethanol production to the tune of $56.1 billion from 1995 to 2006. What did we get in return? In short, really expensive cornflakes. Here's what was supposed to happen. Subsidies would lower the cost of corn, which would in turn be used to create cheap fuel. Everyone would then love their cheap fuel so much that they'd demand more cars be built to utilize it. Car makers would take advantage of the opportunity, and in a few years, we'd all be driving around in cars powered by a crop grown right here in America. Here's what actually happened. Subsidies incentivized farmers to chase the money and use their crops for ethanol production instead of food production. That led to a full one quarter of America's corn crop being used for ethanol, which meant there wasn't enough corn left over for food. That led to increased prices on a slew of things that rely on corn, like beef, which come from cows that eat, yes, corn feed. It drove the price of other crops higher as well, because farmers began to plant as much corn as possible at the expense of soybeans, wheat, and other grains. But all of those problems cover only the subsidy side of corn ethanol. The functionality of it is really what makes this experiment a historic debacle. Corn ethanol is 30% less efficient than gasoline and far less efficient than its sugar-based ethanol cousin. Translation: it takes more energy to make corn ethanol than other fuels. Looking at it another way, 1 hectare, 2.471 acres, of sugarcane yields 7,500 liters of ethanol, while the same acreage of corn yields about half as much fuel. But forget about hectares and efficiency. The worst thing about corn-based ethanol is it's not even clean. A recent University of Minnesota study found that corn ethanol is actually worse for the environment than regular gas. So corn ethanol is not only inefficient and expensive, but it also makes the problem we're trying to solve even worse. Genius. I can see why Washington threw $3 billion at it in 2007, an amount that represented 76% of all renewable energy tax credits.
Who cares? Corn ethanol is yesterday's news. We now realize we could solve a lot of our energy problems if we'd each just make smart choices, like buying one of those cool hybrid cars.
Let's play a game. Behind one curtain is $3,000. Behind the other curtain is absolutely nothing. To make it easy, I'll even tell you in advance which curtain has the cash behind it. You can't lose. Do you want to play? If so, you're in the minority. This game, which is called Buy a Hybrid and Get a Tax Credit of up to $3,400, is being offered by our government to all Americans. Yet only 2% of car buyers are actually signing up to play. Imagine that. After all the media attention, celebrity harassment, and expensive government incentives, hybrids still make up only about 2% of the market. Still, the dedication to the hybrid doctrine is at a near-religious level. For example, take a look at the government's Cash for Clunkers program, which is meant to encourage you to turn in your old clunker of a car and replace it with a more fuel-efficient one, thereby allegedly saving the environment. Sounds great, except for one small problem. As much as 28% of a vehicle's carbon dioxide emissions come from manufacturing it and transporting it to a dealer. Even environmentalists admit that, unless you're trading in a tank for a solar scooter, the best thing you can do for the environment is run your current car into the ground.
Government is great.
Despite the evidence that they're not particularly helpful, either for the environment or for sales, cash incentives for hybrids continue to flow from the government to consumers, who, by and large, don't need the money. Consider this. The purchase of a new hybrid is a better indicator of household wealth than a doctorate degree. The average hybrid-buying household earns $113,400 a year, more than twice the median household income in America. Isn't that exactly the sort of thing liberals are supposed to be infuriated by? We're giving hundreds of millions of dollars in tax credits to households that earn more than six times the poverty line. Yet, instead of outrage, the silence is deafening. Apparently, the environment has leapfrogged the poor on the liberal food chain of victimhood.
Oh, bash hybrids all you want, but they are the only way to save this auto industry.
As Barack Obama was defining his new job as car company CEO, he said, "If the Japanese can design an affordable, well-designed hybrid, then doggone it, the American people should be able to do the same." So my job is to ask the auto industry, why is it you guys can't do this?
ADD moment. I remember everybody making fun of Sarah Palin for saying things like, doggone it, during the campaign. I must have missed the same treatment for President Obama. Man, I should just watch the news more.
But do the Japanese really even do what the president suggested? Is anyone really doing it? And is going green really the best way to bring in the green, as so many people seem to think? The Toyota Prius is far and away the most successful hybrid of all time. Yet even after a decade and over a million cars sold, the Prius is, according to the Washington Post, still widely believed by analysts to be losing money on each one sold. But even if the Prius is slightly profitable for Toyota, it's the exception, not the rule. Consider what other automakers have said about the world of hybrids. Nissan admitted, "Hybrids today are not a very viable economic proposition." Ford is finally hoping to see the light at the end of the tunnel after years of having to subsidize the price of the hybrid technology. Despite having more hybrid models than any other manufacturer, GM reportedly still has years of bleeding red ink ahead, and the outlook on GM's next-generation all-electric Chevy Volt? We won't make a dime on this car for years. In fact, of all car makers, Honda is probably the most optimistic. If we were making money on the Civic Hybrid, a Honda spokesman said, we weren't making a lot. But even with nearly non-existent profits, car companies still have a tough time moving hybrids that aren't named Prius. For example, the Toyota Camry and Honda Civic were the second and third best-selling hybrids in 2008. Yet their combined sales were less than half those of the Prius. The Prius sold at more than eight times the rate of the Toyota Highlander and Ford Escape Mercury Mariner SUV hybrids, and it outsold the Nissan Altima hybrid 18-1. So how has the Prius bucked the hybrid sales trend? By becoming a rolling status symbol. The number one reason people give for buying a Toyota Prius isn't higher fuel economy, lower emissions, or the love of new technology. It's that it makes a statement about me.
ADD moment. In other words, solve your problems by finding a way to stroke people's grego. That's a new term I'm testing out. Green plus ego. Grego. Get it? It's a tough task for automakers, especially considering that it's mostly rich, probably white, people buying hybrids anyway. Oh, the grego of a gringo.
The point is that the Prius was like catching lightning in a bottle. You don't just come up with another one easily, doggone it. Yet that's exactly what the president's strategy is. He is essentially telling American automakers to solve their problems by simply inventing the next ultra-trendy, low-profit, highly subsidized status symbol for the rich. Sounds like a reliable business strategy.
Well, they better figure out a way to make it a reliable business strategy, because Americans are demanding more fuel-efficient cars!
Yes, we want fuel efficiency. We just don't want it at the expense of almost anything else. We like to fancy ourselves driving fuel-efficient cars, but like dropping those last 20 pounds, saying and doing are two entirely different things. Despite all of the green hype, the best-selling vehicles of 2008 were the Ford F-150 and the Chevrolet Silverado. Neither one is powered with celery, eco juice, or environmental magic powder. They're big trucks with big engines that haul big things.
ADD moment. Half of the top 10 cars sold in 2008, including the top two spots on the list, were American vehicles. I'm sorry, but haven't we been told that the big three were making vehicles that no one wanted to buy?
One car you won't find on the 2008 automotive bestseller list is the vaunted Toyota Prius. Even with gas at record levels and the media and politicians never more pretentious and persistent, the Prius didn't even make the top 10. The Ford Focus, a serviceable car for sure, but far from a worldwide celebrity and media phenomenon, finished 10th and still outsold the Prius by 16%. Sure, there were plenty of car buyers who wanted sensibly priced sedans that get decent gas mileage and cost around $20,000. And an awful lot of those buyers even walked into a Toyota dealership to buy a car. But that's when the rubber hit the road. Faced with the choice between the hybrid Prius and the gas-powered Toyota Camry, 71% of those buyers drove off the lot in the Camry.
But maybe their vision stopped them from buying a Prius because of its hideous styling.
Oh, sorry. Try again. The Camry also has a hybrid version that looks exactly the same as its evil, earth-killing counterpart. Yet 89 of every 100 people who bought a Camry chose the gas-powered planet murderer. They must have all been bribed by big oil. The worst news of all for hybrid zombies is that even the Prius may finally be losing its luster. Sales actually fell by 12% from 2007 to 2008. And through the first 5 months of 2009, they're down 45% compared to the same period in the previous year. Those drops are, of course, partially due to the well-publicized rough patch for automakers. But as the crisis worsened, hybrid sales actually plummeted faster than their gas-powered competition. Meanwhile, as hybrid sales were crashing, Ford announced the addition of a third shift to its Dearborn, Michigan plant. Why? To make more F-150s. That extra shift, by the way, will employ 1,000 people and annoy 1 million environmentalists.
People aren't exactly in love with the hybrids yet, but that's only because they just don't know how much money they can save on gas.
Why haven't Americans rushed to dealer showrooms to fully embrace hybrids? Well, because unlike many of our politicians, they find that the potential glory of their peers lauding them as green doesn't shut down the math part of their brains. In 2007, the Department of Health and Human Services sent out a newsletter that instructed its 67,000 employees to make fuel efficiency their top priority when buying new cars. It specifically mentioned the Camry Hybrid and the Nissan Altima Hybrid as two options. Unfortunately for our government, people don't just blindly listen to them. Yes, the Altima Hybrid is more fuel efficient than the gas version, but it also costs a lot more. With gas prices just under $2 a gallon, you would have to drive the Altima Hybrid over 350,000 miles just to make your money back. Even with gas at its peak of $4.11 a gallon, you'd still have to drive the Hybrid 159,000 miles to break even. But it gets even worse. As the Associated Press noted, driving 15,000 miles a year with a commute that keeps you on the freeway, you'd have to drive the car until 2057 to save enough gas to make the hybrid cost-effective, even at record gas prices. I hate to say it, but even that analysis is optimistic because they don't include the extra money you'd spend on financing the car or the interest you'd make on your money by investing the cash you would have saved by sticking with that evil gasoline. In other words, our government is stupid. Surprise, surprise.
Who cares if people want gas guzzlers? Driving more fuel-efficient cars is simply what we must do to save the planet.
I understand the argument. I'd like a fountain of cheddar cheese in my office to be the answer to my double chin epidemic, but that doesn't mean it would be. Likewise, the fact that so many people want hybrids to be a simple answer to lowering carbon dioxide emissions doesn't mean they are. And if you're going to tell me what I can and cannot drive, you better be solving a lot of big problems. Instead, they're creating new ones. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration ran the numbers on what an increased focus on fuel efficiency would mean for the climate. In a 939-page report, which, by the way, generally supported such a move, claiming that it addressed climate change, they found that, if successful, new regulations would shave one part per million from the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by the year 2100. To give that some perspective, the doomsday scenario from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, that is constantly recited by the media, is 970 parts per million.
ADD moment. Oof. There are so many ADD thoughts in my head right now, I don't even know where to start. First, remember that these completely insignificant decreases aren't the result of one town making changes in fuel efficiency. It's our entire country, aka the largest economy in the world. All of those wonderful benefits are depending on the science of global warming being correctly settled. We went into much more detail on that science in my number one New York Times bestseller, An Inconvenient Book. The consensus is you should listen to it, or at least buy it. Ever notice how the only time the conservatives just blindly trust the New York Times is when their names appear at the top of the bestseller list? It's weird, isn't it?
But that's just scientific jargon to most people. Global warming is about temperature, right? Well, the new regulations would result in an estimated total decrease of 0.004 degrees Celsius, or 0.0072 degrees Fahrenheit by 2100. In other words, it would save us 1/1600th of the doomsday-level global warming we're constantly told to be so petrified of. In fact, the potential decrease is so insignificant that it's equal to only 1/45th of the margin of error in the past century's temperature change. Want a way to make this even easier to relate to? Try this. Put your thumb and finger about 1 centimeter apart. For those of you who understand the superiority of the good old English system, that's about 40% of an inch. Now, cut that distance in half. Now, cut it in half again. Now, again. Again. One more time. The remaining space between your thumb and finger is about how much the proposed efficiency standards would decrease the allegedly forthcoming sea level rise. The grand total is 0.04 centimeters by 2100, which is equivalent to 1/15,240th of the sea level rise Al Gore warned about in An Inconvenient Truth. Focusing on increasing fuel efficiency might be worthwhile to keep America from having to bow before slimy dictators, but government mandates aren't the way to accomplish that. And if your goal is combating global warming, you're completely wasting your time. A study for the journal Energy Policy by experts at Monash University in Australia laid out what changes would really be necessary if the politicians of the Green Revolution get their way. Our calculations show that not even the best combination of fuel efficiency, hybrid and electric cars, alternative fuels, and carpooling could provide the reductions needed to meet the 2050 targets for avoiding dangerous climatic change. These changes would require a near total shift from the private car to public transport. Their bottom line on the automobile is of particular significance as our government claims to be able to save the planet and the auto industry simultaneously. The car, they said, is doomed. With predictions like that, it's hard to figure out whether to laugh or asphyxiate yourself with a fossil fuel-created plastic bag and a little exhaled CO2.
Well, fine. It might not save the world, but there's only upside to the government raising fuel efficiency standards.
If there is an upside, it's very difficult to find, but that's not going to stop our government from trying anyway. After all, they have political points to win, and they're not going to allow a few pesky facts to get in the way of collecting them. So in addition to putting pressure on the consumer side with massive incentives and tax credits, they pressure the automaker side as well. No, they don't tell the car companies what cars they can make. They'd never do something like that. But they do have a tool that's not nearly as obvious and just as effective. CAFE standards. CAFE stands for Corporate Average Fuel Economy, and the standards were implemented in reaction to the Arab oil embargo of 1973-74. Without boring you with the details, CAFE forces each car company to hit a minimum average fuel economy across their entire fleet, with differing standards for cars and light trucks. Politicians love the standards, and, depending on the poll, between 78 and 92% of Americans are in favor of CAFE standards being raised, because, really, who doesn't support higher gas mileage? As Christmas 2007 approached, President George W. Bush saw an opportunity to appear bipartisan, so he signed the first major hike of CAFE standards since 1975 into law. I'm sure the polling data didn't have anything to do with it. As a result of the new legislation, automakers would be forced to raise their overall fuel efficiency by about 40% by 2020 to a fleet-wide average of 35 miles per gallon. Environmentalists cheered, politicians posed, and logic wept in the corner. As you may have noticed, one thing that the auto industry did not need was an expensive new mandate forcing them to create more unprofitable cars that buyers don't want. The changes were so disliked by automakers that they were even fought by Toyota, the Enviro Angels from the land of the rising sun.
ADD moment. By the way, that's the same rising sun that has nothing at all to do with global warming.
At the time the new CAFE standards were announced, the EPA had rated 1,153 different vehicle models for gas mileage. Guess how many hit the newly proposed efficiency standards in both city and highway categories? Half? Maybe 100? How about 20? Nope. 2. The Toyota Prius and the Honda Civic Hybrid. That's it. A few other models hit 35 miles per gallon on the highway or in the city, but not both. And all of those were compacts or subcompacts. Exactly 0 SUVs qualified, including the hybrid models. In other words, these new standards would cost automakers around the world a lot of money to meet. But new leadership and new circumstances bring new ideas. After all, elections have consequences. So, under President Obama, and with auto companies in a slow-motion, very public collapse, these new onerous restrictions would surely be loosened, delayed, or canceled, right? Of course not. As a matter of policy, the Obama administration is seemingly dismantling everything the Bush administration did well and doubling down on everything they did terribly. Within a few months of taking office, not only did Obama show unwavering support for the new CAFE standards, he also presented a plan to force the auto companies to meet even tougher standards 4 years earlier. The new CAFE standards increase will add about $1,300 to the price of every new car, according to that extreme right-wing organization, the Obama administration. You won't be surprised to learn that some outside observers find that estimate to be optimistic. For example, Bob Lutz, former vice chairman of General Motors, estimated the additional cost of the less restrictive Bush standards at $6,000 per vehicle. The higher CAFE standards have other consequences as well, like eliminating thousands of auto industry jobs that the government claims to care so much about. The Bush plan would have cost over 11,000 jobs by 2015, while the plan most similar to Obama's ups that number to almost 49,000 lost jobs. I guess Obama isn't doubling down on Bush's bad ideas. He's more like quadrupling down.
Oh, everything is always about money with you conservatives. Well, some things are just more important.
You mean like safety? Killing auto companies is one thing. Killing people is another. When car companies get hit with higher mileage standards, they have to try their best to make cars that people still want to buy, while also complying with the government. They typically don't do that by inventing magical new superfuels, especially when the timeline is tight and the standards are so difficult to reach. They do it by making their cars lighter, because, to state the obvious, lighter cars get better gas mileage. Unfortunately, when lighter cars get into accidents, more people die. The National Academy of Sciences estimated that CAFE standards kill about 2,000 people every year, along with between 13,000 and 26,000 additional incapacitating injuries and 97,000 to 195,000 additional overall injuries.
ADD moment. Between 97,000 and 195,000? I mean, could they have been a tad more specific? I mean, why not say, we estimate CAFE caused between, like, 1,000 and 3 trillion additional injuries. It's somewhere in there.
An analysis done by USA Today found that CAFE killed an additional 46,000 people, and that was only through 1999. That is approximately the combined death toll of 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina, times 10. Another study by economists Robert Crandall of the Brookings Institution and John Graham of the Harvard School of Public Health also found that CAFE was likely responsible for tens of thousands of deaths. They reported, "The negative relationship between weight and occupant fatality risk is one of the most secure findings in the safety literature."
ADD moment. Graham also said, "To the best of my knowledge, these findings have never been disputed in the peer-reviewed scientific literature." I'll have to check my Al Gore playbook, but does that mean we should now end this section because the debate is over? Rich.
Well, weight is just an excuse. Quality and engineering, they're far more important to safety.
Let's think this out for a second. When you add $1,300 in pointless regulation to the cost of a car, what do you think the consumer can afford less of? Things like quality and engineering. The supposed evidence behind this claim is a clumsy reference to a 2007 study from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety that found the Mini Cooper is safer than the Ford Excursion. While the Mini Cooper does perform slightly better than the average automobile, it's the only small two-door car that did. The study showed that that category has a fatality rate about 2.5 times as high as large or very large SUVs. Additionally, it showed that you have about 3 times the chance of dying in a light car than you do in a heavy one. And this is the study they want you to look at? Could we continue talking about tragedy and death on the roadways like we're a 1960s classroom driving safety video? Sure. But let's leave our road trip through the infuriating intersection of environmentalists, government, and automobiles on a positive note. Remember those incredibly ugly station wagons with the wood paneling on their sides? Most people believe that they went away because they were incredibly ugly and had wood paneling on the sides, but actually, CAFE standards killed them off. Okay, CAFE and the fact that they were unbelievably ugly with wood paneling on the sides. The station wagons weren't fuel efficient enough to hit the new standards, and car companies had little choice but to make them extinct, which probably would have happened anyway because they had, well, incredibly ugly wood paneling on the sides. But people still had families. They still had to go to the store and pick up furniture or groceries. They still needed a way to carry around half the Little League team and all of its equipment. So automakers shifted their focus and worked toward creating a vehicle to meet this demand in the light truck category with a less restrictive efficiency standard. What was their most successful solution? The sport utility vehicle. Anyone who says environmentalists have never brought us anything good isn't being fair, because we can all thank the green movement for the creation of the SUV. I'll make sure to think of that the next time my giant Escalade is crushing a smart car like a monster truck.
Chapter 5. Unions. When is America finished paying her dues? When unions first gained power in the United States, they gave mistreated and beleaguered workers the right to collectively bargain in the face of tremendous disadvantages and hardships. Brave men and women stood up and stared down politicians, special interests, monopolies, and robber barons, and fought for fairness and a slice of the American dream. They didn't demand special rights. They demanded equal rights. Boy, have times changed. We've gone from a world where labor unions sacrificed for the right of all American workers to collect a fair wage to a world where big labor sacrifices their workers in exchange for more power and influence. These days, unions have become powerful political machines that work against individual rights in favor of special interests. They look down on fundamental American ideals like competition, capitalism, and freedom of choice, and instead embrace monopolies and bureaucracy, the very things they once fought against. Fortunately, most Americans aren't fooled. A recent Rasmussen survey, mirroring many other polls, found that 81% of non-union workers do not want anything to do with union representation. Overall, only a measly 9% said that they would actually like to join a union. Like a Roach Motel, or is it an Eagles song, you can check in anytime you like, but you can never leave. ADD moment. Maybe the 9% of people who'd like to join a union aren't smart enough to understand this, but no one's stopping them. It's like telling a pollster that you'd like to wear a blue shirt tomorrow. Well, why not stop talking about it and do it? Even those who find themselves in danger of losing their jobs, a group of people you'd expect to be wildly interested in the security of a union, aren't pining for representation. Among those companies that are laying workers off, just 9% of employees are interested in joining a union, the exact same pro-union percentage as the general population. Survey results like that are probably why union membership has been in a free fall. In the late 1950s, one-third of all private sector workers belonged to a union. By the mid-1970s, that number had dropped significantly. But a quarter of all private sector jobs were still unionized. Of course, the mid-1970s also brought us Jimmy Carter and the Bee Gees, so something was clearly off. But now, unions are basically an afterthought. Only 7.6% of non-government workers belong to one. ADD moment. Why do I have to keep saying private sector and non-governmental? Well, because unionization of government jobs is 5 times higher than that of private ones. The reason for this is simple. Private companies care about pesky little things like, you know, profits and maximizing shareholder value. As any good business person knows, unions result in higher labor costs and more red tape. Two things that hurt a company's ability to compete, but two things that a government monopoly could not care less about. Over time, it's become obvious that workers who get to choose between job security and success almost always bet on their own success. And with the multitude of laws that now protect workers from management abuse, along with a diverse job market created by free enterprise, most people have realized that the red tape of unions does nothing but hold them back. The ones who haven't? Well, they're the idiots that say things like, "Oh, come on, Glenn! Unions are only trying to level the playing field for the working man!"
Have you noticed how union groups talk like it's still 1930 and their members are headed down into the coal mine without any water or flashlights? Guess what? It's not 1930. These days, workers have rights, protections, and benefits that those from the early 20th century couldn't even fathom. So, why are unions still around? Good question. Easy answer. They've got a lot of friends in very high places.
ADD moment. Politicians and unions are involved in a very convenient partnership. Unions take money from their workers and give it to politicians to help them get reelected. Politicians, in turn, ensure that unions maintain their power.
During the 2008 election, candidate Obama promised that he would offer a more union-friendly administration, saying, "This election is our chance to finally have a president who doesn't choke saying the word union." Unsurprisingly, unions responded to that sentiment big time. They worked as if their lives depended on electing Obama and other Democratic candidates across the country. And, in some ways, maybe they did. With dwindling membership, a growing irrelevance, and the marquee companies they bargain with disappearing faster than Obama's campaign promises, it was only a matter of time before unions would be fighting for their very existence. To prevent that from happening, unions, long ago, decided to start paying a lot more attention to political campaigns. According to Open Secrets, a website that tracks political fundraising, Big Labor made up 12 of the 20 top donors from 1989 to 2008. Here are those 12, along with a mystery percentage for each. See if you can figure out what it is. Big Labor, big donors. Number 2, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, 1%. Number 6, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, 2%. Number 7, National Education Association, 6%. Number 8, Laborers Union, 7%. Number 9, the Service Employees International Union, 3%. Number 10, Carpenters and Joiners Union, 9%. Number 11, the Teamsters Union, 0%. Number 12, Communications Workers of America, 0%. Number 14, American Federation of Teachers, 0%. Number 16, United Auto Workers, 0%. Number 17, Machinists and Aerospace Workers Union, 0%. And number 20, United Food and Commercial Workers Union, 1%. The percentage mentioned after each union is, drumroll please, the amount of money each group has given to Republicans over the last decade. Yep, of the 12 big unions that made the top 20 list, every single one of them leaned strongly towards the donkey with their contributions. In other words, for 10 straight years, the communication workers, teachers, auto workers, and aerospace workers unions have given a combined $0 to Republicans. That's some balance. I guess we should be thanking the carpenters for stepping up to the plate with 9%. The truth is that most unions are no longer workers' rights groups, they're political action committees. They don't work to enact changes in their own companies or industries as much as they work to enact changes in laws that will help them claim more power and influence, something that's about as far away from their original mission as you can possibly get.
Government is great!
Many people who are forced to join unions don't appreciate that their dues are used as political donations to elect a candidate the member doesn't even like. But what many members don't know, because the unions don't exactly advertise this, is that they have something called BEC rights. Seriously, that's really the name. Based on a 1988 Supreme Court decision, workers cannot be forced to pay any dues other than the amount specifically needed to fund their collective bargaining. That gives me an idea. How about we unionize all union workers with the intent of collectively bargaining with their leaders to reduce membership dues?
Okay, they may be more involved in politics than they used to be, but unions still help stop employees from being intimidated at work.
If management intimidation is really as bad as many claim, then why do 60% of all private ballot elections in which workers decide whether or not to form a union actually succeed? Isn't big, bad management supposed to be pulling the fire alarm or calling in a fake bomb threat anytime a few workers sit down together in the lunchroom? When management intimidation does undermine union efforts to organize, and who are we kidding, that certainly does happen, there are about a trillion laws on the books, give or take, to make sure that someone pays. The National Labor Relations Board gets plenty of complaints about unfair labor practices, but those complaints are levied against both sides, employers and unions. Unions claim to only want a level playing field, but what they really want is special treatment. Despite winning 60% of workplace elections, union leaders are still dragging out the intimidation myth and using it to argue that secret ballots are no longer fair. Their proposed remedy is something called the Employee Free Choice Act, or EFCA, aka card check, and it's an idea that's been around for a long, long time. The difference now? Big labor savior, President Obama.
ADD moment. Since there are no limits to the idiotic names politicians attach to things, why not just go on a retroactive renaming campaign? Let's call the internment of Japanese Americans the Involuntary Vacation Act. Or the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act can be renamed the Socializing of America Act. And the War on Terror could be turned into something much friendlier sounding like the Overseas Contingency Operation. Oh, wait.
The National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, currently oversees anonymous, secret ballot workplace elections supervised by impartial federal regulators. Unions want to trash that system because, they say, management has too many opportunities to scare their workers out of voting yes. And that's where card check comes in. It eliminates secret ballot elections in favor of public ones. Very public ones. In fact, under card check, there are no elections at all. The voting can be done via a piece of paper passed around the office. If a majority of employees sign that paper, poof, you have yourself a union. Think about it. You're minding your business on the welding machine when a few guys approach you. They hand you a clipboard and a pen and give you a little talk about the benefits of union membership, along with the possible consequences of not playing nice. Are you going to sign? Of course you are, and a few signatures are all it takes for a union to be recognized. Card check moves the election from a private voting booth to a private meeting between you and the organizers. If the idea that merely getting a majority of employees to sign a card can result in an official union scares the bat crap out of you, then buckle up, because it gets much worse. The EFCA has no regulations or safeguards that mandate what voting cards must look like or say. Not the size of the card or font or even the language. In fact, the only requirement seems to be that the card has to contain a single vague line somewhere mentioning that the card authorizes a union to represent the worker. Believe it or not, despite all of the yelling about card check, it isn't even the most economically destructive demand in the EFCA. Another provision, far less talked about, is one that would impose binding government arbitration if the employer and union failed to reach agreement within 90 days of a new union's being certified. Imagine how this would play out in a private business. You are haggling with a prospective boss about your salary. A few months have gone by and you haven't yet reached an agreement, but you're getting closer. Suddenly, there are some uninvited visitors in your waiting room. It's the feds. They're there to inform you of your new salary, along with what your benefits will be and what your raises will be for the next 5 years. In another era, that was called communism. Given this provision, unions would have exactly zero incentive to bargain in good faith. After all, why bargain when you can get exactly what you want, if not more, don't forget those political contributions, simply by waiting a few months for the government to ride in on their white horse and save the day? The bottom line is that unions believe that a 60% win rate is for losers. They dream of the day when every American worker is in a union, and more important, paying their dues, whether they want to be or not. Fortunately, even with Obama in the White House and a Democratic majority in Congress that unions helped to put there, card check is such a terrible idea that it still might not pass.
Will you make it sound as if unions don't care about their own workers? That's ridiculous!
Do you ever wonder what kind of positive changes organized labor could make if they didn't spend hundreds of millions of dollars trying to buy elections? How much good do you think that kind of money could do in the private sector? Or a charity? How many jobs could unions actually create or save? How much better could the benefits be? History is littered with examples of groups that began with the best of intentions, but were eventually hijacked by people who cared only about accumulating as much money and power as possible. As a result, these groups lose sight of their original mission and instead waste money on things like lobbyists, when it would be far better spent on their own constituents. In the middle of the EFCA campaign, the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, the fastest-growing union in the country, fired 75 of its 220 employees. Despite spending a holy fortune electing Barack Obama, they couldn't scrape together a few thousand bucks to salvage the jobs of some poor schlubs in their own organization? That should prove pretty definitively where their priorities really lie. In the irony of ironies, the laid-off workers filed unfair labor practices charges against the SEIU with the National Labor Relations Board. I'll pause here so you can let that soak in. If you can believe it, there is actually an organization called the Union of Union Representatives that represented the aggrieved union workers. Dumb question, but if unions are so fair and magnificent and necessary to workers, then why would union employees need unions to protect them from a union?
ADD moment. Please tell me that there's a union of union of union of representatives that would work on behalf of the union of union representatives that worked on behalf of the fired union members. I mean, that would just make my year.
So why did the SEIU fire those poor, hard-working souls that have the right to a job, a fair wage, fair benefits, fair blah, 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 blah? Here's the explanation, straight from the top.
"This is not a financial issue," explained SEIU President Andy Stern. "We need to respond to the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity our members created by helping elect President Obama."
Huh? I guess with that kind of nonsensical double talk, it's not a surprise that Andy Stern heads a union. The SEIU spent $80 million during the 2008 election cycle to get their candidates elected and was planning to spend tens of millions more to advocate on behalf of universal health care and card check legislation. In other words, they spent money on politicians instead of payroll. If that's not a financial issue, I'm not sure what is. Remember when the SEIU branch in Nevada gave a key endorsement to Obama that put him over the top there? That, along with their millions in campaign contributions, apparently bought a lot of goodwill in Washington. Goodwill they are all too happy to cash in. You may have heard that California has had some budget issues, i.e. they were about $42 billion short. As programs were cut and taxes were raised, it became clear that sacrifices would have to be made by everyone, everyone except the SEIU. After losing their battle over cuts in wages of home health care workers in Sacramento, they went to Washington instead. Officials there lent a sympathetic ear, and California was threatened with the loss of $6.8 billion in federal Medicaid money unless they reconsidered their cuts.
ADD moment. Want to know exactly what $33 million in campaign contributions buys you? Well, it turns out that the SEIU was given unprecedented access to a conference call between Washington officials and state officials who were talking about the proposed wage cuts for home health care workers. "This is an unusual situation," said a spokesperson for the California Department of Health and Human Services. "It's incredibly unusual in our experience to have stakeholders on a call like this."
In Illinois, Hart Marks, a men's suit maker, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection after being unable to pay back $141 million in loans from its bank, Wells Fargo. Seems pretty cut and dried, except for the fact that Hart Marks plan employees are represented by the SEIU. The union turned to the state government, and we all know how ethical those Illinois politicians are, which then publicly threatened Wells Fargo, not with violence, but with something much worse. Loss of business. It turns out that Wells Fargo is the custodian for the Illinois state portfolio and, as the Illinois state treasurer put it, unless the company remains open, Wells Fargo will not be doing business with the state of Illinois any longer. Is it just me, or does the word extortion come to mind?
Okay, so the unions throw their weight around a little bit, but when companies fail, the unions, oh, they suffer just as much as management does.
Not quite. Unions, especially ones that help to elect our politicians, often seem to be exempt from sharing in the necessary sacrifices. One of the best examples of this is the failure of Chrysler. After the company declared bankruptcy, the unions walked away.